Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Chris from Delaware.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date, which is December 24th, 1996. I have a home group, South College Speaker Group. We meet Wednesday nights from 8:30 to 9:30, and it's a speaker meeting just like this. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. And I just always like to start out saying that because it helps me to not be so nervous when I'm up here. This is not my favorite thing to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. So with that being said, I like how you guys turn the lights out so I can't see too much out there. Anyway, I guess I'll start out, you know, what it was like. I don't know, when I first started going to the home group that I have now, I heard people talking about, that feeling of, not being connected, and I could tell you, I was around Alcoholics Anonymous for a while before I heard people talking that way. I heard people talking about, their problems, coming into meetings and saying, what a bad day they had, and a lot of people with a lot of time that still wanted to drink. But when I started going to what's now my home group, I heard people talking about things the way that I'd never heard before, and it fit right with me. They talked about that feeling of, never belonging, and when they said it, it was like one of those, aha moments, because I had felt it all my life, but I didn't know how to say what it was that I felt, and I can remember being that, young child thinking, I must be adopted, I don't fit in with my family, I had a hard time. I just thought I was just, an extremely shy kid. I was never, loud enough. I had friends, but more on a one-on-one basis. I didn't do well in big groups of people. And I grew up in Chester, Pennsylvania. And, I grew up in a family that it was okay to drink. My grandfather owned a bar. My dad was a bartender at that bar. And we would go and clean the bar every Sunday. I hung out there a lot. My dad would frequently give me sips off his drink, and I'm talking as a toddler, and it was just, I just grew up in a time that was acceptable. Other people did it. I mean, they gave you alcohol in your gums when you were teething, it was just more of an acceptable thing to do. So I kind of grew up in that environment of drinking, and I remember, my dad would frequently give me sips of his drink, and then when I was 10, he would start giving me a whole beer, we would have some sort of family function and he would be here you go, you can have this one beer. And, by that point I was already sneaking beer, or I was sneaking whatever wine they had in the refrigerator, because I liked the way it made me feel. I liked that feeling of that sensation, that burning going down my throat, and that was something, I don't know that I knew what it was to get, to feel that buzz, but I liked the way that it felt going down my throat. I remember drinking pickle juice for the same reason, because it took my breath away, So anyway, when I was 13, my grandfather passed away. And it's a big part of my story because he owned this bar. And when he passed away, all the alcohol from this bar came back to my house. And it was just, stuck in boxes in my basement. And my dad didn't drink it. It was a dive bar in Chester. I mean, my dad was a wild turkey drinker. He had enough money to get what he wanted to drink. He didn't need to drink this old, real drink stuff. And that allowed me to drink when I wanted to drink, And I ended up going to high school right up the street from my house. So frequently my friends and I would come back home or come back to my house during lunch, drink, and then go back at the end of the day for them to catch the bus, So by the time that I was 15, I was drinking on a regular basis, and I was starting to have some consequences for that. Because, of course, at 15, I didn't want to stay home and drink, I wanted to go out and I wanted to do things, and I would do stuff, I would stay home until, my dad was a truck driver, so he wasn't home during the week, so I would stay home until my mom would go to sleep, and then I would, sneak out my window and go roam the streets, and, I was failing out of school. I just was a very I don't know, I would say I was like this shell of a kid, you know, until I drank, you know. So I'm failing out of school. I'm not doing too good. And I end up at 15, I was getting in trouble. My mom and dad started to like record my phone conversations, and they put like a lock on my window. They knew the kind of stuff that I was doing, and I was getting into a lot more trouble than just with alcohol. And you know, they ended up like locking my, I lived in a ranch house, and they put locks on my window so that I couldn't get out. So I ended up like, you know, going out the side door, you know, like and one night my dad was like a really big scary guy, and I used to be petrified of him, but I wasn't so petrified that I wouldn't go out to get a drink, you know. And, you know, it was like one night in the middle of the night, and I guess they probably had listened to my conversation. They knew what I was planning to do. So I went to, like, the kitchen to the side bathroom to get changed before I was going to leave. And he came out into the kitchen, and he was like, "What are you doing?" You know, and I was in the bathroom, and I was just like, I'll be going back to bed in a minute. And he went back to bed probably assuming that he had scared me enough to go, you know, back to bed. And I didn't. I left. And when I got home that morning, they were waiting for me, you know, and they told me, and this was like one of those like big resentments that I had, because I was in ninth grade at the time, and I was failing out of my typing class because I had missed so many days, and the teacher had told me if I was absent one more time, I was going to fail. So my parents are waiting for me this morning, and they're like, "You're not going to school. You're going to see this drug and alcohol counselor," you know. And I was like, "You are going to make me fail," you know, like it was their fault that I was going to fail because I had to miss like one more day of this class. And I went to this drug and alcohol counselor, and I couldn't tell you. I mean, the only thing I remember from this is I went in there for a couple minutes. The guy asked me some questions. I refused to talk to him. I went and sat out. My parents went in, and they came back with the, "She needs to be institutionalized. She's an alcoholic, and she's depressed." And I was like, I didn't even talk to the guy. You know, like, well, he doesn't know anything about me. So what ended up happening is my parents' insurance, I guess, wouldn't pay for it, you know. So they couldn't do anything at that time. But, you know, a few weeks later, I once again, like I had, my dad was out of town, and my mom had came home from work, and she was really tired, and she took a nap. So I decided it was a good idea to take the phone off the hook so nobody would wake her up and to go out. And, you know, and I went out, and I was hanging out with, you know, like this group of older kids, and we were like driving around in cornfields, just, you know, drinking and being destructive, and they weren't going to bring me home in time. And my brother was working, and he was going to be home, like, by 9:30, and, you know, like, it was just, like, a big mess because they weren't going to bring me home in time, and, you know, and they got me home just in time, and my brother swore he wouldn't tell, and, you know, but like I said, my parents were recording everything that went on, so they knew, well, besides that they were recording everything, this guy that I was out with that night decided to come back to my house at midnight because we were all, you know, drinking, and we were pretty messed up. And he came back and decided to knock on all the windows of my house because he couldn't figure out which bedroom was mine. You know, so he wakes my mom up, and she's like, you know, "What are you doing?" And I mean, I don't know what he said, but when he left, he decided to steal some things out of our yard. Like, my dad had this great big fishing cooler, and he stole a hose from my neighbor and siphoned their gas. So, you know, the next day, like, my dad was going to be home, and when my mom noticed the cooler was missing, she was like, you need to go get this stuff back. And it was during the summer. And I left the house with, you know, this was like early, like 1985, you know. I had on a half shirt, jeans, and I was barefoot. And I made the decision when I left that I wasn't going to go back. You know, like, I was so prepared to go out and face the world dressed that way. You know, and I left, and you know, I ran away from home, and I ended up, like, I made that guy that knocked on the windows, like, he was going to be responsible for me running away from home because he made it impossible for me to go back. Like, my dad was, like, furious with me at this point. And, you know, I just was gone for, like, 8 days. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't that bad. Like, I had a job at Burger King at the time, so I, like, withdrew all the money out of my account. I drank every day. You know, like, it was summer, so we hung on the sides of, like, this creek, and in Newark, Delaware anyway, you know, so I got to stay to the all-night party, and I got to live the way I wanted to live, you know. But the whole time, like, my plan was to, you know, because like I said, like, I was just this shell of a kid, and I was just this really, like, depressed, suicidal child all the time. You know, I wanted to die. Like, I had several suicide attempts at that point, and I thought, like, the money that I had left this guy that I held responsible for me, like, he was supposed to help me get a gun because I was going to shoot myself. Like, this was my big plan. Like, I was going to have a few days of fun, and then I was just going to kill myself and get it over with, you know, because I was so, like, hopeless on the inside. And, you know, obviously that didn't happen. What happened was we were on our way to, it was like a Friday night, and we were going to go to, like, Cecil County Racetrack, and which is just a big, like, hillbilly drinking thing, and we were on our way there, and I was in the back of this T-top car, and you know, we're on our way out of town, and my dad just happened to pull up right next to us, you know, and he's this great big guy, and he gets out of the car, you know, and it's like me and two other girls in the back, and I'm sitting right behind the driver, and he, like, grabs me by the hair, you know, because of this T-top, and you know, like, raises his fist to the guy, so he jumps out of the way, and he takes me home. And, you know, it was probably, like, I had a hard time with my dad over this for a long time because he took me to the house and he made me sit on the steps while he called the police. And he had me arrested for underage drinking, you know. And he wouldn't let me come in. He wouldn't let me get shoes. You know, like, I was still in the same clothes that I had ran away in 8 days before. And, you know, I went, the cop came and he put me in handcuffs and he put me in the front seat. You know, and the whole time he's like, where you been? Who you been with? And I'm like, and I'm bawling, and I'm like, you know, like, arrest him. Like, he's a no good father. Like, you know, and I'm blaming it all on my dad. And, you know, they take me to the police station, and they, like, put me, this is, like, my whole big thing, my big jail time. They put me in a holding cell for a couple hours, you know, handcuffed me to the wall. And, you know, and when I walked in, they were like, oh, is she a murderer? You know, I mean, because I was, like, grungy and, you know, shoeless and this half shirt. I mean, I looked like a mess. And, the social worker came in after a couple hours and took me into this room and made the phone call to my parents. And they said, you know, my dad, because I don't think my mom would have been able to do it, but my dad got on the phone and he said, you keep her. We don't want her, you know. And the lady was like, why did you get her? You know, why didn't you just let her be where she was? And, you know, why did you bother to, like, pick her up if you didn't want to take her back? And she said, well, at least bring her clothes. And my dad said, she doesn't own anything, you know, like, you deal with her. And, you know, I was, like, so resentful at him over that for such a long time. So I ended up going to this shelter for runaway kids. And, well, it's actually not for runaway kids. That's where they take runaway kids, but it's actually for abused children, you know. And they took me to this shelter. And when I first got there, you know, like, it was not where I wanted to be, obviously. But the whole thing was my parents were trying to get me into that rehab, you know, that, like, from that drug and alcohol counselor, and they couldn't do it. And my mom, like, I didn't know any of this was going on, but she was going to these tough love meetings, and they were trying to give her ideas on how to get me there, you know, and they were trying to get me to, you know, they told her to be confrontational to me so that I would hit her so she could have me arrested and then the state could pick up the tab, you know. And she kept telling them, like, she will never hit me. And the truth is, I don't think I would have ever hit my mom. Like, that, like, just never crossed my mind. I mean, I would have ran away and did stuff like that, but I would have never laid a hand on my mom. So, like, you know, I played right into what they wanted by running away. And that's what they were trying to do. They, like, by not letting me come home, they were trying to get me into this rehab. So, you know, when I went to this shelter, there was this lady that worked there at night, and because they had given me, you know, I guess I had had a few visits with the social worker, and they'd given me, like, a couple choices. Like, I could go, they were trying to get me into this rehab, I could go to this rehab, or I could go to foster care. Like, those were my options. And I was really considering the foster care because I didn't want to go to rehab. I didn't want to go back to my parents ever again. Like, I just hated them at that point. And, you know, this lady, she showed me her coin. She had just celebrated a year, and she convinced me, you know what, like, just give it a shot. You know, like, if you don't like it, like, alcohol will be there when you get out of this rehab. Like, just go and give it a try. So, you know, I stayed in that shelter for 3 weeks, and then I went to this rehab in Norristown, Pennsylvania, and you know, when I went there, it just, I don't know why I just remembered this, but the last day I was at the shelter, they had, because like I said, it was for abused children, so they tried to do like lots of fun things, and they had somebody come in and paint everybody like a clown. So I went to this rehab with a clown face, you know, like this adolescent rehab where I'm already feeling like I'm not going to fit in. You know, and when I went in there, they were like, you need to go wash that off, like, before you meet everybody else. But, like, I go there, and it's like, I was in an adolescent unit because I was only 15, and it was like me and one other girl and 16 guys, you know, and I thought, like, this isn't so bad, you know? And they had, like, a smoking room, like, you could smoke all, like, you know, they didn't care that you smoked all day long. You had a maid, like, it was a really nice facility compared to what I've heard other people say, you know, and I had a lot of fun in that place, you know, and I stayed there for 3 months, and to tell you the truth, like, I was petrified to come out of there. I don't remember hearing about the 12 steps while I was there, but what I do remember, you know, like, they talked about being an alcoholic, and I don't even know if I got a true definition of what an alcoholic was, but I was willing to think that possibly I was an alcoholic. I just wasn't ready to quit drinking, you know. But I thought I would give it a try for my family. You know, like I thought, I mean, because at that point, like, we had family sessions, and I was still really angry at my dad, but not my mom, and I wanted to go home. So, you know, I was willing to give this a shot. So, you know, I ended up coming home, and it was like Thanksgiving time, and things were like, you know, it was difficult. I had turned 16 in there, and I came home, and I had to go back to school. You know, I had missed, like, you know, the first few months of school, and I was, you know, I just didn't want to, like, I still had, like, really a fear of people, and I hated, like, being in situations where I was around a lot of people, and, like, school was really tough. So to go to school without, like, drinking or doing anything else was really a hard thing to do. So I decided, like, you know, when I didn't want to do something when I was in that rehab, I would really just put the covers over my head and say, I refuse to do it. So I started doing that at home with school. Like, I just refused to go to school. So my junior year, I ended up missing, like, 108 days of school. So I failed. And, you know, like, I really tried to not drink. And I would have probably told you before, like, I really didn't drink during that time, but I did a lot of other things to not drink, you know. But the truth is, like, I drank when I got the opportunity because my parents had started to, like, have some trust with me again. And they would, they liked to camp, you know, and I had gotten a job, so I couldn't always go with them. So I would be home on the weekends by myself, and I would drink when I could, you know. And I was always doing something else. Like, I couldn't live just, you know, being sober. I just didn't know how to do that. And then when I was a senior in high school, again, I failed 11th grade, and I didn't start my senior year out too well. And, you know, I was, like, really considering dropping out of school, and I ended up getting pregnant. And, you know, for whatever reason, you know, like, that happened, and I, you know, I'm, like, really grateful because I ended up just stopping everything I was doing and studying, you know, and doing what I was supposed to do for school, and I ended up graduating. But I can say, like, that first time being pregnant, you know, it was really hard not to drink, but more, like, I thought it was more like the social thing. All my friends were going out and drinking, you know, like, we had prom, everybody got wasted. Like, I smoked a little bit of a joint and ended up, like, getting really sick. You know, it wasn't fun, like, I was watching everybody else had. So I, like, had a constant pity party for myself. And I thought, like, being pregnant was such a sacrifice. Like, this child should be so grateful to me, you know, like, I haven't drank this whole time that I was pregnant. You know, and my friends were like, we'll bring you a fifth of Jack, you know, and some other things, like, when you give birth. And, you know, of course, nobody showed up with anything. But I had my son, and I just remember, like, the first time going out drinking. It was only, he was, like, a couple weeks old, and I went out to a Halloween party, and I got drunk, and I came home, and I felt so guilty. You know, like, he's, like, laying there trying to lift his little head up, and I'm wasted. And I'm thinking, like, this isn't what I'm supposed to be doing, you know. But it didn't stop me. You know, I continued to do that, and I ended up, you know, like, the whole thing with the baby's father, like, we didn't really even know each other. We got married. I ended up having another baby, you know. So I'm, like, 19 years old. I'm married to a guy I can't stand. I have two kids, and I have absolutely no idea what I'm doing, you know. And, you know, and again, like, I don't think, like, drugs and alcohol are my problem. You know, I think, I just don't know, how to live my life is my problem, you know, which is my problem. You know, but, at the time, I don't know. I just remember, thinking, I need to find something. There's got to be something else out there. So I ended up, leaving that relationship and getting into another relationship because I'm always thinking it's the guy, you know. I'm always thinking, if I find the right guy, I'll feel okay. He'll take care of me and everything will be all right. And I end up, in this other crazy relationship, and I was in this one for, 4.5 years. And it's just the same thing all over again. But then by this time, time's going on and my kids are getting a little older and I have no idea what I'm going to do. You know, I'm constantly jumping from place to place because I'm dependent on somebody else for where I live, you know, and then I'm getting thrown out and then I'm sleeping on my friend's couch with my two kids or I'm sleeping in my car with my kids, you know, just a lot of moving around. And so I end up, my parents helped me get this little trailer, this 10x48 trailer, and I was on welfare. I couldn't hold a job, you know, and my life is just complete shambles. I'm 22 years old. I have no idea what I'm going to do. So I decide, the best thing for me to do is to join the Army, you know, because I'm thinking, if I join the Army, that, I'll get, 10-month break from my kids while I'm, at boot camp. I'll get in shape. I hear they drink, and there's lots of guys. This is my thinking, you know? So I go, and I was going to join, the reserves because, I could get that education and hopefully get a better job and hopefully be able to take care of my kids. So I go, and I do everything I need to do for that. And, when I took the test, and I did well in that and the physical, and then, when it came down to it, they told me, because I was a single mom and I had custody of my kids, that at that time that I could not join the Army unless I gave my children to somebody else, you know. So I made a decision not to do it. And then I thought, I have no ideas left. And, what happened was, a couple months later, nothing, really different than any other night that I go out drinking. You know, I went out this one night. I got my cousin was 13 or 14 years old. I got her to babysit. I promised my aunt that I would have her home. I was going to go to the bar, have a couple drinks, and then drive my cousin home, you know, with my two kids. And I was going to have her home by midnight. 2:00 in the morning, I'm at the ex-boyfriend's house, you know, and I'm, I ended up getting, really beat up by his friend. I'm wasted, you know. I come into my trailer with my cousin, standing there, I'm covered in blood, and she's bawling. She's got to call my aunt to pick her up, and I'm absolutely in no shape to drive her home, you know. My aunt's furious, and, you know, and then, you know, what happened, it's 3:00 in the morning, and I get a phone call, you know, somebody's got something, you should come out, you know, and I had that, moment of, I really wanted to go, but I really knew that, that's not what I should be doing, you know, that moment of clarity, I guess. You know, and a couple of days later, I ended up at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I don't know, I don't remember having, a clear idea that I came here and wanted to stop drinking, you know. I just didn't want to feel the way that I felt anymore because I was so, hopeless. And I don't know, I don't know that I thought alcohol was my problem. I just know that I needed something, you know. And for whatever reason, I ended up at Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I did, my beginning experience in this program was a lot different than it is now. You know, when I got here, I remember hearing a lot of, fake it till you make it, 90 meetings in 90 days. Just a lot of these, you know, think, don't think, don't drink. And I had no idea what I was supposed to do. You know, absolutely no idea. I heard a speaker one time say that she thought the steps were there to enhance your sobriety. And I could say, that's the feeling that I got. You know, they weren't here to get you sober. They were here if you, you know, could stay sober for a while and then you wanted to get better. So that, you know, I hung around, I fellowshipped, and I had this, I ran into that woman from the shelter. That was my first, there must be a God experience because I ran into this woman and I was it has to be, it can't be a coincidence. It has to be God, you know, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And, you know, she had celebrated 8 or 9 years or whatever it was at this point. And, you know, I asked her to be my sponsor and, you know, I don't fault anybody because, you know, like the AA in my area at that time, like it was all about like this, like self-help, you know, group therapy type AA. And she was too busy, and she like passed me off to one of her sponsees who was just as crazy as I was. And we had a lot of fun, you know, but this woman had like ideas like, you know, because, you know, I'm just going to say this, like, I was 23 years old. Sex was a big problem for me. You know, like, I'm like, you're telling me to stay away from men. Like, men are, like, what's going to get me through. And she was like, well, you just go pick up a guy from the bar and bring him home. Then you can just drop him back off. Like, this was who was trying to help me when I first came to get sober, you know. So, anyway, I forgot I'm being recorded. Oh, no. And anyway, so... So I struggled a lot in the beginning. You know, I'll just tell you that. Like, I had a lot of my old ideas, and, like, I liked maybe some of what I was being told, and I didn't like the rest, you know. But the one thing that I was doing was I was hanging in there, and I was doing a lot of fellowshipping, and I was going to the dances, and I was doing that kind of stuff. And fear of alcohol kept me from drinking. You know, I was petrified to drink because I came in here at a time, you know, I don't know, like the time period I came in here, a lot of people passed away that like I had got to meet and they went out for one night and they died, you know, and I had always wanted to die, but for some reason I didn't at this point. So I'm like, I was so petrified to drink that like I was going to go out there and I was just going to die, you know, so it kept me from drinking for like 8 months. And I got a sponsor, and I got a guy sponsor because you said to get a girl sponsor. Like, I did things the way that I wanted to do things, you know, and I got this guy to sponsor me, and he really tried to help me the best he could, you know. I mean, he made every attempt, you know, to take me through the steps in the way that he knew how, and, you know, and he tried to, like, I don't know, to be there, like, you know, he would pick me up. I was crazy, and I would go, like, out to the, all my friends would go to the club, and I would go to the club, and then I would be, like, totally insane and want to drink, and I would call him at 4 o'clock in the morning, and he would come get me, you know, and I had that boyfriend, that on-and-off relationship, and he would, like, go out once a week and get drunk and call me. And I would do things, you know, like I would complain to people, like I was such a victim, like he won't stop calling me, like every Saturday night, like clockwork, 4 o'clock, he's calling me, you know, and they're like, don't answer, you know, and then, or change your number. So, you know, because I was this victim, like I changed my number and then I made sure that he got it, you know, like I wasn't ready to let go of that. So this one night, like I really was getting to the point where I was just like, I couldn't take it anymore. And he was calling me, and I wasn't answering, and then it stopped. And, you know, like, I don't know, like, I had, like, complete, like, homicidal thoughts. And I went to his house, and he was passed out. And I, like, stood over him, like, I am just going to kill him. Like, I just wanted this guy dead. And instead, I, like, stole his bag of pot, and I went home and called my sponsor. You know, and it's like I said, like, 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, and the sponsor, he comes and picks me up, and he takes, you know, and flushes the bag of pot, and, you know, and he tells me, like, you know, you got to stop doing this. Anyway, what ended up happening, I ended up drinking not too long after that. You know, I couldn't hold on anymore. And, like, once I drank, I got complete relief. You know, I can say that. Like, I got complete relief from my craziness. Because the other thing that happened, you know, like, I thought alcohol was my problem. And I put alcohol down. 3 months without a drink, I ended up committed in a psychiatric unit. You know, like, you can't tell me alcohol is my problem because I didn't have any alcohol at that time. And I could not stand myself. And people were telling me, like, everything's catching up with you. There was nothing catching up with me. My head wouldn't shut up. I couldn't get it to stop for 1 second, and I just wanted to die. You know, so I ended up, like, committed to the psychiatric hospital at 3 months without a drink. So, it, you know, like, 8 months when I picked up a drink, like, I got some relief. And, another really funny thing, like this sponsor, he was going to the Delaware convention that weekend, and I had just picked up a drink, you know, and I think I just went out like one night, wasn't even anything that exciting, and like we go to the convention, and they did like a countdown, and they were like, you know, the person with like the most sobriety to the least sobriety, and both like the most and least got a prize. I had like 2 days sober, so I'm like, I'm sure to get a prize, and there was somebody there with 1 day sober. And I was like so pissed off over that, you know? Like I should have drank last night. And, you know, anyway, like, I ended up, after that, like, the fear was gone. The fear to drink had left. So it was much easier for me to pick up the next drink. You know, I couldn't get, I could maybe get a couple months, then I could maybe get a couple weeks. Until I finally, 3.5 years of doing that, I met a guy in AA, and he wasn't, alcohol wasn't his thing. And we started to do his thing, you know, something I had never done prior to coming here. And, I made a decision. When I went to that psychiatric hospital, things happened. I got hooked up with somebody that helps me get a scholarship for school. So I went to school for 2 years. I got my associate's degree in accounting. I was in school for my bachelor's degree, and I hooked up with this guy and we bought a bigger trailer and, we're doing our thing. And I decided Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. I can't stay sober. I'm making 90 meetings in 90 days. I have all friends in AA. I'm doing the things that I think I'm supposed to do. I have made attempts to go through the steps. It is not working for me. So I make a decision to stop going to meetings altogether. Maybe if I just try to drink just like everybody else. I had gotten a good job. And people were going to happy hour and doing that kind of stuff, and I wanted to go do that too. So once I made that decision, it was the best thing I did for myself, because coming to meetings, being on the fence, was a really hard place to be, So once I made that decision and I just went and drank the way, the way that I wanted to drink, for a little while I got some relief. And then what happened, I had this good job, and I ended up pregnant again. And I told you, I had already had 2 pregnancies. I quit drinking when I needed to. And this time, I could really see how I had lost all control, because I could not stop drinking. As much as I knew that it was wrong, I couldn't put down a drink for more than a couple of days. So, I ended up, it was Thanksgiving time, and the day after Thanksgiving, the boyfriend asked me, to marry him. And the next day I had a miscarriage. And, at that time, it was probably one of the lowest points in my life, because, I think it's really funny to think about, because at the time, I really thought it was because I drank too much coffee. I'm going out and I'm drinking shots, and I'm getting drunk and I'm blaming it on caffeine, that I had this miscarriage. But it was definitely, I think in my heart, I knew, I contributed, and the shame and the guilt was overwhelming. And it was one of the lowest points of my life, but I am really grateful for it, because I stayed home. I lost my job. I sat in my house from that day until, December 23rd was the last time I actually went out and drank. And I just, I didn't participate in anything, and I just drank, I made a decision for whatever reason. Nothing exciting happened again. I just made a decision on December 24th. I had destroyed my Christmas tree and, a few things. And my kids were coming home for Christmas. And I made a decision to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and to just not drink as long as necessary. To hang in there, like they said. They just said, just hang in there. And I thought, maybe I'm just giving up too soon, it seemed impossible to just not pick up a drink, but maybe I'm just giving up too soon if I just hang in there a little longer. And that's what I did for 7 years, I just didn't drink. And what happened was, the obsession to drink eventually went away. But the obsession to die never went away. I didn't want to drink anymore. After a few years, it didn't happen. I remember sitting at my first year anniversary and thinking, God, why didn't I get a pink cloud that everybody talks about? I still wanted to drink. I still wanted to drink right after my 1 year anniversary, which I thought was going to be the magic number. Maybe if I make it to a year, you can do all these great things after a year, maybe I'll feel better. And it didn't happen. I stuck to a lot of women's meetings. I tried things different. I got a woman sponsor. I got a lot of really loving sponsors that really tried to help me, went through the steps, in a different way than, I have, with this time with my sponsor. But, it was more I did a 4-step and I did a 4-step. I've done 2 4-steps with sponsors who cried for me, I was a victim. So, I wasn't saying, in the big book where it talks about that we're selfish and self-centered, I couldn't see that, and nobody had been able to point it out to me that till that point. And maybe they tried and I just wasn't willing to listen. I don't know. But, anyway, what happened, in that time period is, I'm still thinking, like, it's all these outside things. Like, if I just had, because when I got here, like, I'm living in this little trailer with my two kids on welfare, not knowing what I'm going to do with my life. Now, at this point, I have a bachelor's degree. I have a good job. I have four kids. I got married. I have a house. I have a brand new car. I got a built-in pool put in my backyard. I have everything that I thought was ever going to make me happy. And I am dying on the inside. I absolutely hated my life. And I'm looking out my kitchen window thinking, like, what is wrong with you? Like, you have everything you ever wanted, and you still want to run your car into a tree. Like, there's got to be something mentally wrong with me, you know? And I had, like, started going to, like, counseling and thinking, like, I'm just never going to get away from feeling this way. And, you know, what happened was, like, after... we ended up getting married. Well, that was a whole nother thing. Like, because my idea was to get married. Like, if I just had the husband, and because I wanted to have more kids, but I needed to be like, I needed to do this different. Like, if I could manage how I did everything, maybe I would feel complete, And, he wanted to wait. He got sober a week after I did, and he wanted to wait until we at least both had a year. So, as soon as that year hit, I was like, we got to get married. And he was like, we are not ready to get married. So I told him, like, you either marry me or you get out. Like, that's your choice. And he left. And then he came back, and, like, 2 weeks later we got married. And, that didn't last. I mean, that was all part of my plan. It didn't work out. 5 years, we didn't make it 5 years, and we ended up divorced. He had a sponsor who took him immediately through the steps, and he got relief. I didn't have that experience, and I, like, sponged off of his sobriety for a long time. I stayed sober because he stayed sober, and I was absolutely miserable. And how long can anybody stay with somebody who's that miserable? So eventually, he left, and I guess I was, like, 6 years sober when he left, and I didn't know what else to do besides start to fellowship again, And I happened to go to this meeting where this guy talked about, it was a beginner's meeting, and this guy wasn't even from, like, the area. He just lived in Delaware for a short time. He was from Florida, and he was talking about the Big Book, and he was talking about it different than I'd ever heard before, and he was talking about, like, all the answers being in the Big Book, and, like, I've thought that I've heard people say the answers are in the Big Book, but for some reason, like, I have screwed up thinking, and I thought, like, it was like a magic eight ball, and you would shake the Big Book and open it up, like, and ask it a question, and it would, like, whatever page you landed on. I don't know where I got that idea, but that's how I used it. Like, I didn't read it from the beginning to the end, like, that's how I used the Big Book. And, when he talked about it, like, it sparked some hope in me that there was something different to this program than what I had experienced for years. And I started to seek a solution in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what I was seeking, but I started to seek something, and in doing that, like, I ended up, everybody was talking about this new meeting that had just started and how, like, they had all these great out-of-town speakers, and I happened to go there, and I heard something different than I'd ever heard before. And they had a speaker, standing from the podium, and this speaker went through each step, and when they did, like, what it did for me was, like, I was like, I didn't get that. I didn't have that experience when I went through that step, like, That's not the way that I saw things. So I got to see that what I did was completely different from what this person did. And I thought, I don't know what it was, ego, I guess. Like, I thought, like, I had 7 years, like, it's too late for me. Like, I can't experience that now. For whatever reason, like, that was just the way my thinking worked. And, I went there a few more times, and I ended up getting, I ended up asking, the chairperson, like, if there was anybody that sponsored women, and at the time there was no women from this group doing things this way. So he was like, no, but, like, let me introduce you to my sponsor. And I have a guy sponsor today, but it is for completely different reasons. He's got definitely, like, a piece about him that I found attractive and I wanted. And he told me that his job was to put my hand in the hand of God, and that was it. He wasn't going to, like, make me call him every day and, like, run past him everything I was going to do. He was going to let me experience my life, after he took me through the 12 steps, and I was going to be able to share those experiences with other people, And he explained to me, like, what it meant to be an alcoholic, And I had heard these things. I had heard that we have an allergy to alcohol, but I could say, like, I never really thought, like, I thought it was an excuse that we used to tell people. Like, if I went out and somebody said, like, why aren't you drinking? I could just say, I'm allergic. I didn't think that I was really allergic to alcohol. You know, the mental obsession, like, I knew that I obsessed about things, but I didn't know that it was part of being an alcoholic. I thought that that was a separate issue that I needed to seek outside help for. You know, I mean, I think I was really fortunate to not get medicated because of that, because I had obsessive thoughts. And then, you know, he talked about, like, the spiritual malady. And when he talked about, like, I think the thing that struck me the most was that alcohol was my solution, because I had thought, like, alcohol was the enemy and alcohol was my problem. You know, and I'd heard people say, like, it's just a symptom. I didn't know what they meant by that. And when they said, you know, that it was my solution, like, it fit right with me. Like, I knew what they meant. It worked for me for a long time. And then when it was taken away, I ended up committed to a psychiatric hospital. Like, I know that, like, it wasn't the alcohol. It was me, you know, the whole time. And that, you know, when he explained these things to me, and, like, I'm on the phone with him, and I didn't, like, he talks really fast and really quietly, and I'm trying to listen. And the next thing I know, he's, like, giving me directions for a third step, you know. And I was like, wow, like, it was like a half-hour conversation, and he just took me through the first three steps. When I had done this out of, like, the Hazleton, you know, no offense against the Hazleton, but it took me a really long time to get to that point. And I didn't understand anything, you know. And he just, you know, he had said to me, you know, about the second step that, like, I needed to just have some open-mindedness and willingness. And I needed to just believe that there was something bigger out there, you know, because I had, like, an idea of what I thought God was and what I thought God could or wouldn't do, you know. And he just said, like, Chris, like, you're limiting what this God is capable of doing for you. Just believe he's bigger. You know, and it was like such a freeing feeling to not have to, like, try to explain to somebody what God was or wasn't to me, you know. And the third step, you know, my experience with that was I was full of fear. Like, when he told me to go, you know, and find some time alone or find some quiet time where I could be alone and get on my knees and humbly from my heart ask God, like, to not make this about my head, but from my heart. Like, I had this fear that he was, you know, I was going to do this, and I was going to ask God to, like, you know, I was going to ask God to use me how he wanted to. Something was going to, like, be so changed about me, like, I wouldn't be able to live my life. Like, this is my fear. Like, that, because my sponsor goes all around and sponsors all these people, and he, like, is all over the place, and I'm like, I have four kids, God. Like, I cannot do that. Like, this was my thinking. Like, I really hope he doesn't ask that much of me, you know, and, like, I don't know where I get my, like, these thoughts from, but, you know, I didn't have, like, any, like, powerful moment at the third step. But what started to happen was, like, all that, like, that feeling of wanting to crash my car into a tree started to go away, you know, because that was a daily thing. Like, you know, I just didn't want to live anymore, you know, and I didn't want to, like, hurt my children and, like, go commit suicide. But if I could make it look like an accident, it wouldn't be so bad as the way that I thought, you know. And I stopped thinking that way somewhere along the line. And he gave me directions for the fourth and fifth step. And I'll just say, like, you know, like I said before, like, I had read in the book and I'd heard people talking about being selfish and self-centered. And I could tell you, like, you were all selfish and self-centered in my opinion, but I was not. You know, like, it was really like I did things because I was a good person, you know. And then once it was pointed out to me that I never did anything without expecting something in return, you know, and it was clear when I, like, sat with him, like, three people down, like, I felt like I was so humiliated, you know, like, I was just so, like, oh, my God, I am so selfish. You know, I'm such a victim that I am not accountable in any of my relationships, you know. So that was, you know, he said, that's good news, Chris, because you only have control over you. And I was thinking, that's not good news. Like, I, like walked away from there feeling really, like, really embarrassed, you know. And it was good news, because I do only have control over what I do. And if I had to wait for those people to change, you know, I would still be suffering. And then, you know, I'm just going to talk real quick about, like, 8 and 9. Like, he told me to go and take, like, everybody off my four-step list. And I've had, you know, like I said, I've done four steps before, and we, like, burned them. You know, you didn't want anybody to ever see them. And he told me I needed to take the names off of that list and transfer it onto a new list and then add anybody that I had harmed. And, you know, like, when I met with him, he was like, how come your kids aren't on the list? You know, like, for some reason, I didn't think they counted. You know, like, I don't know what I was thinking, because I was still very selfish. You know, I was thinking, like, I didn't, what do you mean? Like, I took care of them. I fed them. You know, like, who cares that I, like, left them while they were sleeping and went to the liquor store or went out for a little while. You know, like I was just very caught up in myself. And one of the most with the nine step, you know, like my first reaction was to go. There was a few people I needed to make amends with that I was going to see right away. And my ex-husband was one of them. And he was in the program. And I went to make amends with him. And, you know, it didn't go the way that I thought it would. You know, like I really thought that it was going to be okay. He was in the program, you know, and I went and told him. I stuck with what my sponsor said to say. And, you know, he was irate, to say the least. And he, like, went on this whole tangent, like, that's not the way you make amends, you know, and he proceeded to make amends to me, you know, and, you know, like, I know why my sponsor gave me the direction that he did, you know, to not cause more harm. And I left there thinking, like, oh, my God, like, this was horrible. Because my sponsor told me the most important thing for me to do is make my amends and then shut up and listen to what he has to say and not debate it, you know, and to call him. And I did, and I called him, and I said, it was horrible. Like, I can't believe how bad that went. And in hindsight, you know, like it was the beginning of a change in our relationship. You know, like that day may not have been good, but it opened up something else, you know. And today we're friends. Like today, I mean, I work for him. You know, like we have a completely different relationship. You know, so that was just the beginning. And then the other one was my dad. Like I was resentful. Like I could tell you that with my dad, like anything good about me, he had nothing to do with. Anything bad about me was all his fault. You know, like I just absolutely resented this man, and he was still married to my mom, and he wanted to have a relationship with me. And he called me all the time, like, go to lunch with me, like, why don't you come over for dinner? And I would like just avoid him. And you know, my sponsor told me, like, my job is to be a good daughter, like, stop worrying about what kind of father I think he is, and just be a good daughter. And you know, that I needed to. I didn't believe him. Like, I can't say that I thought, like, everything he said was going to work out. But he told me, like, to just focus on what I do and not what my dad does. And I started to do that. You know, I started, like, when my dad asked me to go to lunch, I went to lunch. You know, and it didn't happen, like, the first couple times that I went with him anywhere. But eventually, like, what happened was, like, the resentment went away. And, like, my relationship with my dad, like, completely changed. You know, like, his last 5 years of life, like, we didn't have any fights. You know, like, the way that I dealt with him was completely different than I would have before. And then, you know, like, without me ever saying, because I really thought in order for our relationship to change, I would have to go to him and say, Dad, like, you need to change A, B, and C before we can have a relationship. You know, and I didn't do any of that. I just became a better daughter, and as a result, he was an awesome father. You know, and I got to see a lot of really good things about him, and he passed away last year. You know, and I'm just so glad that I followed direction with my sponsor and did that, because I wouldn't have been able to have that relationship that I had with him, you know. And then, you know, 10, 11, and 12, you know, they helped me to stay current. You know, I love, like, the 10-step promises are my favorite because, like, I used to fear alcohol, you know, and I don't have to fear it anymore. Like, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid to go anywhere or do anything, you know, as long as I'm on good spiritual condition. And most days I am. You know, like, because I stay in these three steps. I don't go places and, like, think, oh, my God, it smells like alcohol. I can't stay in here. I don't look at what people are drinking anymore. Like, none of that bothers me. You know, and sometimes I forget, like, when new people are talking about, like, oh, I went in there and it smelled so bad. You know, I'm like, I forgot that I used to be that afraid. You know, I forgot that I used to worry about what somebody else was drinking, you know, and why they weren't finishing their drink. I don't think about that at all anymore. You know, 11 has been like my, like lately, I don't know, like it's just been like that seeking, you know, like I continuously seek to have this relationship. And it was just explained to me that, like, if I want to have a relationship with God, I need to, you know, I need to talk and I need to listen just like I do anybody else, you know. And I take that, like, I don't know, like the past few months, especially, I guess, like I've been like on this, like, really like the seeking mission with that, you know, more like I think I go through it from time to time, but just like I really try to devote like a good hour to it in the morning, and it changes the way that I look at the whole day, you know, and I feel connected, and I'm able to get up and do things like this that I wouldn't have been able to do before. I would have been petrified. You know, I can definitely like handle situations that I wouldn't have been able to handle before. and working with others. I can definitely say, having had a spiritual awakening after going through these steps with my sponsor, I started to look at life differently, and I was able to, the first time I took somebody completely through the steps, it was just, I'll say the fifth step, when I did a fifth step with them and I saw the lights go on in their eyes, it was the absolute best feeling I've ever had in my life. I remember calling my sponsor, I was just so happy. I was like, oh my God, this is what I've been missing all my life. I've never felt so good as doing anything like that. And it doesn't change. The more I do it, that is what puts this whole thing together, is working with others. And I used to hear things like, this is a selfish program, protect your sobriety, that kind of thing. And my sponsor said, it's a help others program. And if I come in here and I think that I'm just going to stay to myself, go through the steps and see what I can take, I'm going to be a very lonely, miserable person. But if I come in here and I see what I can give, and I try to reach my hand out to somebody who's hurting, then I'm going to be blessed, And I really feel that way today. I mean, my life is an absolute complete turnaround, and it's not just I have a lot of great stuff that I always thought, I still have the house. I'm in school. I'm going for my master's degree, I'm going to be a grandmother in a couple of months. I don't know, my life, I have, four beautiful children that I get to participate in their life. I have many wonderful friends, that love me. I have a good relationship with my mom today, and I'm happy. I think this is the most important thing. I always wanted to be somebody else. I was never content with who I was. If I just looked like her, if I had her job, her boyfriend, all these things that I thought, if I had, I would be okay. And for the first time, I'm content being me. My life's not so bad, and it's only through doing this, through the help of my sponsor, to have this relationship with God and to be able to share it with other people. And that's all I have.